Hi everybody, welcome to Read Science, and today is the happy birthday edition. Happy birthday to my co-host Jeff, and I'm going to turn things over to him for first announcements.
Thanks very much, Joanne. Today's episode is special for reasons other than just my birthday. This happens to be the first episode of our third year doing Read Science.
Oh, yeah.
Which I think is very exciting, and we are revisiting a topic that we first talked about nearly 2 years ago. The subject is cancer. Today's guests are author Sue Armstrong, whom Joanne will introduce in a moment, and George Johnson, author of The Cancer Chronicles, Unlocking Medicine's Deepest Mystery. George Johnson describes himself as, I'm quoting from his website, a writer working from his office in Santa Fe, New Mexico, which I'd say is true if over-modest. He also wrote that he was, quote, more comfortable with the sharp edges of cosmology and physics than the wet, amorphous, ever-changing terrain of cancer, which is pretty much how I feel about it, too, being a physical scientist, but I'm here to learn. Of his 9 books to date, the 2 next most recent were The 10 Most Beautiful Experiments from 2008 and Miss Leavitt's Stars, The Untold Story of the Woman Who Discovered How to Measure the Universe from 2005. He's been shortlisted 3 times for the Royal Society's Winton Prize for Science Writing. He's a co-founder of the annual Santa Fe Science Writing Workshop. He's written for a number of magazines that are familiar to all of us, and he is currently writing a monthly column for the New York Times called Raw Data. Thanks very much for joining us from Santa Fe, George.
Oh, thanks for inviting me.
Okay, Joanne.
Oh, and I get to introduce Sue Armstrong, who I think this hangout's been about 6 months in the works here. I was looking back at when I first corresponded with you, Sue, because I was looking, well, what do I add to her bio here? So Sue Armstrong is a science writer and foreign correspondent who has worked for a variety of media organizations, including New Scientist and BBC World Service. Since the 1980s, she has undertaken regular assignments for the World Health Organization and UNAIDS, I hope I said that right, writing about women's health issues and AIDS, the AIDS pandemic, among many other topics. The author of A Matter of Life and Death, Inside the Hidden World of the Pathologist, and today's book, P53, The Gene That Cracked the Cancer Code.
You've got the wrong one there.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Back here is P53.
All you white books spots on them. Okay. P53, The Gene That Cracked the Cancer Code, both by Armstrong, and she lives in Scotland, and we're on a little later than we planned originally. My fault. Totally my fault. You can't trust me with world clocks. Sue, welcome, and say hi to our audience.
Thank you very much. Lovely to be with you. And happy birthday, Jeff.
Thank you very much, Sue.
Yeah, nice. Jeff, one of these years we'll hit my birthday, and yeah, we won't tell anybody my age, so we'll keep it a secret. That's the one old-fashioned thing I happen to like.
Yeah. Okay.
Jeff, why don't you start off with a question for our guest?
Well, And let's keep it big for a moment, because it seems to me that one theme that keeps coming up in these cancer discussions that certainly is behind every chapter of both of these books is how big the question of what is cancer? One word, but the thing's so big. And even more profound, now that it's my birthday, I can recognize that and say how much cancer understanding has changed even in my lifetime. And so I'm going to quote something from George's book that I thought said a lot about that. This is your essay question. He wrote, "Things are rarely as simple as they seem, and what appears to be complex may be no more than ripples on the surface of a fathomless ocean." Oh, sounds portentous, but things have certainly changed, and the way we thought we understood cancer when Nixon was president, we'll get to that, is a lot different from the way we understand it. So, in 50 words or less, George, would you like to survey everything that's happened in the past 50 years?
Sure. I mean, really the key idea is that cancer, unlike any other disease, it's not an infectious disease, although sometimes infections can trigger a cancer, but cancer is an example of Darwinian evolution going on in your body in a very sped up manner. And the way I like to think about it when I was writing the book is that it's almost like a little quasi-organism or a quasi-creature or would-be creature is trying to evolve inside the ecosystem of your body. And what from the point of view of the us, the bodies, are dangerous, deleterious mutations are, from the point of view of the cancer cell, advantageous mutations. It's becoming fitter and fitter, and to the detriment of its host. So I think the really key idea, you can trace it back, quite a few decades, but many people look at a paper written by Peter Knoll on what was called the clonal selection theory of cancer. And basically the idea is that, cancer randomly generates mutations and then they're selected for fitness. And that's why it's so extremely difficult to treat, because whatever you throw at it, it's likely to evolve a workaround.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so...
If I might answer that also, I would say one of the big difficulties of cancer is that, in a way, it's just ordinary life got a little bit out of hand.
Yes.
That's the terrible thing about it. That's what makes it so desperately difficult to address, because it is, to a certain extent, one of the great mysteries is when you have a wound on your arm or something like that, it'll fill in the space, and somehow your body knows when the wound has reached the surface and it stops. But with something like cancer, it can be the same kind of thing. It's the same filling in holes, it's the same multiplying, and it's the same ordinary growth systems, but they just don't know when to stop. Or it's death things which don't know when to happen as well. So it takes over the general systems of living and they just keep going. That's the problem.
You two are going to agree vehemently on this as well, that that cancer is almost a thing that is just a consequence of being alive, that it is part of being alive, that it, as you say, Sue, and as George has also written, it uses all the mechanisms of living, and this is where it comes from, why it's so multitudinous in its forms, and also why most of us can't escape it if we live long enough.
Yeah, it's essentially, I'm sorry, it's... Again, a way I think about it, when I write about cancer, is that it's really an inevitable consequence of the fact that we're multicellular creatures and we're living in a world that's governed by entropy. Things fall apart. As things get more complex temporarily, it's only at the expense of creating disorder somewhere else, and eventually the system's going to break down. So if you don't die first of heart disease or a stroke or something like that, at some point you're going to have to die of something, and it's likely then to be cancer.
As we go back to Sue to finish this, I mentioned to Joanne that I read in the New York Times David Kwan's review of George's book, and there was an equation in it that seemed perfectly summarizing the book, and you just mentioned it. He wrote this equation. He wrote down entropy times mitosis times time equals breakdown. And I think this is something that we're going to be talking about a lot as we try to understand, I don't know, the simple view of so much going on. And now, passing back, so P53 certainly has a lot of stuff going on just with this one protein and this one gene. And boy,
it does. One of the things I was going to go back, just to rewind a little bit to what George was saying, one of the things that's fascinating is, yes, if we live long enough, we're bound to get, we're almost bound to get cancer. It just happens just because of the number of times everything's dividing. But one of the great mysteries is that very big animals don't necessarily, it's not necessarily proportionate. You don't get much more cancer in whales or in elephants than you do in human beings. There isn't a direct relationship between how many cells you've got and how often they divide and cancer. Mm-hmm. So there are lots and lots of little mysteries. But then one of the things I found fascinating about studying biology is that it is It's so beautiful, and yet it's also so messy. You think you've learned something, and then something comes from around the corner that says, "Oh yes, but." And so that's the thing. You can never
There's
say.
There's always an exception.
There's always an exception. Yes. Sorry, to get back to your thing about P53.
No, that's fine. And you made me think. You were talking about large animals. That reminded me that we learned in George's book that we like to think in popular culture, I think, that cancer is a modern man-made thing that comes from living life dangerously in the 20th and 21st century. And now we find out from George that dinosaurs had cancers, that the earliest identifiable hominids had cancers. This is something that has always been around and something that happens to everyone and again is part of life. And you gave a number, I've got it someplace, about the percentage of cancer sightings in the archaeological record. But that's a pretty fascinating place to start. But we're not the only one that gets cancer, and it's not just because of, 20th century chemical processing.
Well, yeah, that's something that was one of the big surprises to me when I started delving into this subject, back around 2010. I guess, if I knew, if I really thought about it, that the cancer must be, something that's been there ever since you had multicellular creatures, because cells are constantly dividing, and every time they divide, they have to copy their DNA. So inevitably, you're going to get errors, and inevitably, in an imperfect entropic world, not all of these errors are going to be corrected, which is a good thing because it's the random mutations in our germ cells that have allowed us to evolve. And you're thinking about all these things, but the really interesting question is to what degree the assaults of the 20th century and 21st century civilization may have increased the amount of cancer. I mean, of course we know that smoking cigarettes has, but let's say you take cigarettes out of the equation, and in one of my chapters I tried to trace back and just find the best case we can make for how much cancer there was in the past. And once you get really to the late 19th century, there's really nothing like good medical statistics and death records. There was a study in England and Wales in the late 19th century, the late 1800s, that was really the last thing that's considered even semi-reliable. And there was one paper that analyzed that and subtracted and adjusted for things like the fact that smoking cigarettes wasn't such a big thing then, or that people were more likely to get stomach cancer for various reasons. And this scientist concluded that you really couldn't make a case that cancer back then was at a different level when you made these adjustments than it was today. So controversial, because there are so many assumptions and variables.
I found that a fascinating chapter in your book when you looked at Love Canal and the assumptions that people make that, there's nasty things happening in the water and nasty things happening in the air and there's cell phones and all this sort of stuff. It must be giving us cancer. And you so carefully sort of filleted all of that and looked at it. I found that deeply fascinating because I know it is one of the big, it's one of the big controversies. Nobody dare say anything about how much chance is involved in getting cancer and so on without everybody piling in, because it's such an emotive issue, isn't it?
Yeah.
As Joanna and I were saying, we were talking about this the other day, that, Bert Vogelstein and colleagues had said something which was picked up by all kinds of newspapers around the world,
yeah,
and just slightly mangled, and it caused a hell of a hoo-ha. And in fact, they were just looking at exactly the same sort of things as you were talking about in your chapter, George.
Yeah, I wrote one of my columns about that, one of my raw data columns, because I read the paper that originally I was given a copy by a friend at the National Cancer Institute, an advanced copy, and I read it, and I thought, this is great. I mean, this to me just seems so obvious that there's a much larger role for randomness than entropy than most people realize, which doesn't mean you have to be fatalistic or that you can't prevent many cancers, but it's saying, let's see which ones we can prevent and which ones are probably mostly the result of randomness, and then try to prevent those, and the ones we can't prevent, you know, are the ones that maybe we can try to treat or even cure in some cases. But it was a brilliant paper, but the reaction of the public, and then when I wrote about the paper defending it, the emails I got, people are just outraged by the idea that cancer isn't caused because you're not eating kale chips or because because the you know Dow Chemical and you know maybe these are factors, but you know particularly kale chips are a very minor
factor. At least a couple of things that have come to mind in those things. One, we can't really have that discussion about the epidemiology of cancer and understanding it, because it's still recent that we understand cancer as a genetic problem, as a problem with genes.
What you say, it's true. You can go on and continue.
Going to add into that mix, and that we're still seeing a lot of people clinging to the idea that the mysterious disease cancer that is still not understood popularly has to have a cause, and their favorite cause is moral impurity or unclean living or some punishment for something.
This is the AIDS debate all over again, isn't it?
Most any debate, it seems like. Yeah.
I mean, I guess I would argue that, you know, even if we had no idea what the mechanisms were of cancer, and we know an amazing amount, but even if we were completely ignorant of it, the epidemiology would still allow you to show that certain things were likely to be risk factors and certain things are not. So,
yes, because for a long time the smoking thing was very much just the epidemiology, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah, very much so. And that's what's so interesting, because smoking, you know, for an epidemiologist, the deleterious effects of smoking cigarettes were just such a strong signal in the epidemiology that it was just, you know, hard to ignore. It's like a risk factor of like 20 times. It raises your risk of lung cancer. Almost everything else you look at, whether it's a chemical pollutant in the atmosphere or red meat or anything you want to look at, it's just a tiny, tiny fraction as big a factor, like so small that it's often indistinguishable from noise. So there's very little that they found an epidemiology that's as clear-cut as cigarettes.
But actually, that's where P53 is so nice, because it clinched the case against tobacco, because when they discovered that the products of tobacco smoke actually mutated the P53 gene, the tumor suppressor gene,
in a very
specific way. And that really clinched it. And what they found was that people who were smokers and had lung cancer had nearly always had this mutation. And it was never in lung cancers of people who hadn't smoked. And so that was a fingerprint mutation. And they found quite a number of them. I mean, I think there are three or four already. I mean, skin cancer has got one. And liver cancer caused by the Aspergillus fungus on moldy peanuts and that sort of thing. So there are one or two very specific fingerprint mutations on the tumor suppressor gene, and I think that's absolutely brilliant. But as you say, for so many other things, they can't find an absolute fingerprint. There isn't the definitive proof yet, and there isn't actually, as you say, sometimes there isn't even that strong a connection or an indication from the epidemiology, is there?
Well, no, that's true. I mean, they're more like suggestions, and then of course there's the standard thing we see where one study comes out particularly about some food, and then the next study comes out completely refuting that one, and back and forth. But it's because we're dealing with signals that are just at the level that they're almost indistinguishable from noise. I really liked in your book how I knew that P53 was involved in so many processes that can be corrupted and lead to cancer. And I think I had a line in my book somewhere that said, after making some of those points, that if you want to start a cancer, take down P53 because you know, domino effects. And but I didn't really appreciate to the extent of its pervasiveness until I was reading your book. So it's just it's really very it's a very interesting way into the subject. I think I think whenever you take a huge, overwhelming subject like cancer, you need to find. Like, I think of it as just like this big amorphous sort of swamp, and you have to find a cut through, and then every person who writes a book is going to find a different path through the subject, and it's interesting to see what how different people pull that off. And,
well, right, I did think...
I was just going to say, I was wondering how many of our viewers actually go, P53, what's that? And I was hoping, so you might be able to back up just a little bit. And wait, before I do that, if you are out there and you have a question about cancer, we do have the question and answer app on, and if you type that in, our guests, I'm sure, will be thrilled to do their best to answer. And so, Sue, why don't you back up a little bit and talk a little bit, obviously, if you want to know everything about P53, you should read this book, but in simple terms...
What is P53? I should have said that right at the beginning. Yes,
that's okay. I'm a cell biologist. Those of you who've watched me enough know this. And to me, this book was absolutely fantastic because all the exciting things that were the initial discoveries that were happening as I was in grad school. So, of course, I'm trying to get an idea of what's going on with it. So it was still unfolding. So it was great to read this book and see the whole story and the number of people you interviewed. We'll get to that in a minute, but please do tell us.
Very basically, P53 is one of the genes that's in the DNA in every cell in our bodies. And one of its tasks is to, as a sort of proofreader, as a sort of quality controller, to ensure that when only healthy cells are allowed to divide and replicate themselves. And so it keeps a watch, and if signals come that the DNA has either been damaged by some outside force or during the process of division when it's copying itself, if the DNA, which is the blueprint, the recipe for the cells, the recipe for living, if that's damaged, P53 will stop the cell in mid-division, send in the repair team to mend the DNA, and then set it on its way again, the cell on its way again. If the DNA can't be mended and the cell looks as though it's going to be dangerous, then it can cause the cell to commit suicide. Because the big difficulty is that if the DNA is messed up, you'd need just one rogue cell, and that can trigger cancer. And so it tries to clear out cells that are, while they're dividing, it tries to clear out the ones that are going to cause a problem. And that's its main task. It's the sort of quality controller across our bodies. And it was named by one of the people who discovered it has since called it the guardian of the genome, because it guards the integrity of your DNA as your cells are dividing. That's basically it. And it's called the tumor suppressor gene.
And P53 has to do with the weight of the actual protein.
Yes, it has a terribly prosaic name, as so many of these genes do. They found it, and they found the protein, and it weighed 53, whatever the units are. And they didn't know what it was, and they didn't know that it was going to be anything that special. So they just said, okay, protein that weighs 53. And that's it, and that's how it stayed.
This was before they started coming up with all these wonderful names for genes, like, we had the hedgehog gene, and then the sonic hedgehog, and the desert hedgehog.
Drosophila, the little fruit fly that we use as a model, those scientists are really well known for their crazy gene names, so...
There's Twist, and so many of them that they're coming to me in a rush and blanking out.
There's a lot, but I just don't know why they left P53 with such a pathetic name. The thing is, when you leave your employment in Britain, you've got something called you get given a P45 form, and so many of my friends keep calling it, oh, you've got a P45 gene.
Anyway, that's wonderful.
And it is the central, it is the most important tumor suppressor in the body.
Yeah, but we don't know how to we haven't figured out how to exactly target it to cure cancer, because sometimes maybe P53 mutates or another protein comes in that can sort of ameliorate the functioning of P53. Mm-hmm. So just because we found this really important central protein doesn't mean we can capitalize on it to cure all cancers, no. Even though it seems really important in most cancers, if not all.
That is one of the really big questions. I mean, I remember when I was first started doing articles on this and so on. It was in the sort of late 90s, and they thought, now we've been studying this gene for long enough, we feel we're at a time when we can really capitalize on all the information. and then suddenly they start to dig away. They think, now we know it. And there's just layers and layers and layers of the onion skin. And when you try to address it, it's just so hard. Because what you have is P53 at sort of the center of the whole system. And either P53 itself can be messed up, so it can't do its quality mm-hmm. control thing. Or you get other things which communicate with P53 to say, they can be hamstrung, or the things that P53 switches on to do its job, they can be messed up, and so you've got just so. Oops.
It's just the sound switching that Google does. It's not to be alarmed. It's her delivery.
You've just got so many things that can go wrong, and so it isn't just a question of let's bend this.
Well, yeah. And it goes beyond. You've got the mutations, the mutations that cause it not to do something, the mutations that cause it to miscommunicate, the mutations that cause it to overactivate and do something. And then you can start talking about how it gets folded and whether this particular folding causes this
right.
or whether this particular folding doesn't cause that. And it seems like sort of the one thing we know and is still getting unraveled is that P53 seems almost always to be at the center of the action. And that I finally understood when I was getting, say, to the last third of your book, Sue, the gene that cracked the cancer code. I'm thinking, what is it that we're talking about? And the answer seemed to me to be that understanding how cancer works could be illuminated extensively in all of its complicated facets by seeing the various ways that P53, who's almost always on stage, is getting involved in what's going on. And there are so many ways to do it. And that is back to the rhetorical question I was going to ask earlier. When I remember, I was not all that old, but I was not all that young, when President Nixon declared war on cancer, and the idea was that we were going to find the cure for cancer. And my question is, do you think that declaring war was premature when we understood the enemy so little as we did in the early 70s?
Yeah, I mean, you could declare war at any time, but it's certainly, I mean, I think it's, you know, I mean, he was looking for something, you know, dramatic and rhetorical, like, Kennedy going to the moon, but, I mean, declaring war was probably the wrong metaphor, because it gives you this idea that cancer is kind of this monolithic thing that, that can be defeated in the same way that so many infectious diseases have become not defeated, but seriously vanquished, at least in the developed world. And as we were discussing before, you know, with cancer, something that's so woven deeply into the very nature of multicellular life, there's always going to be cancer. There's never going to be a cure for cancer. There's going to be treatments. And some will be better than others. There'll be some cancers that can be cured, and you know there already are, and many more that can only be controlled. But and I think so much of it too depends on, you know, maybe a better goal back then would have been to say we want to find a way to prevent cancers in young people. Because those are the ones that are the most tragic. And we've made huge progress with that, just with like the cervical, cervical cancer vaccine, the antiviral vaccine. So, I mean, something like that could essentially, you know, come close to wiping out this one, you know, form of, you know, just very pernicious cancer, or stopping smoking, or researching into childhood cancers. We've made great progress on curing childhood cancers, even though, even though sometimes the, you know, the cures can lead to some brutal after effects. But
I think 40 years ago, I think people easily expected that we'd find the vaccine that would cure cancer.
Well, yeah, like polio and smallpox.
Yeah.
It's not the same.
But the cervical cancer thing is a very interesting one, because the cervical cancer one where they have got a vaccine, and that's coming back to what you said earlier, Jeff, that almost every time you're looking at cancer, when you look at what happens to the P53 gene, that's always a player in the field. And the cervical cancer is very interesting because there's the virus that causes that. Often causes cervical cancer. Something in a protein from that virus actually goes in and it just chews up the P53 and gets rid of it that way. And that's how that gets that starts. So P53 is very, very implicated there. And so you can almost always find it somewhere in the equation. But
but you can continue. So I think the root of what I was getting at maybe was, does the course of cancer research in the last 50 years underline something that would be, you know, important to me as a physicist? The usefulness of basic research to understand what's going on before you set out to find the cure for something. You're only going to find that.
Yeah.
I mean, now we know by understanding the 714 different ways that P53 gets involved.
But you know, there is a very interesting thing, because one of my interviewees actually said, you know, people have begun to feel that, oh, we're never going to really get on top of cancer. And he actually said, I mean, he was a great guy, because he kept on saying things that were counterintuitive or that really rubbed people up the wrong way, but were really mischievous things. And he said if you look at bacteria and look at what we've done with infectious diseases, at one point when you see just how fearsomely fast bacteria mutate and bacteria manage to get their way around antibacterials and so on. And yet, instead of saying, oh, well, we've got a bacterium for TB, we've got TB of the lung, we've got TB of the bones, we've got salmonella, we've got all of these things, we didn't have to find a cure for all of these. We found a broad spectrum antibiotic. And we did phenomenal things with infectious diseases. And he actually feels that what we should be looking for in cancer is the commonality in cancer, what he called the mission critical thing, the thing without which no cancer can survive. And this might be just a common factor that there might be one or two of those that we can actually attack. And I think that's a very nice way of looking at it.
Yeah, I was really struck by that when I read it in your book, because I hadn't seen anyone make that comparison before. And it really seems to work. And you know, almost everything you read now, the first thing they say is that, oh, cancer is not a single disease. And then for a while they said 100 or 200 or it's 10,000, depending on the graininess of your definition. Everyone's cancer is individual. And yet it's all basically the same concept, you know, of a cell breaking free of these interlocking controls that are in effect in a multicellular organism. So maybe the difference with being able to control so many bacterial infections and cancer is, you know, again, you have the entropy factor with cancer. So, you know, every time you read about something, it'll say this will prevent, you know, so many thousand or so many million cases of cancer in the next so many years. But what that doesn't say is that the same people may go on to get an entirely different kind of cancer later in their life. So, and again, the older you get, you know, and the more entropy has a chance to, you know, work against your cells, the more likely it is that the system will eventually break down. But as far as delaying it further and further into life, you know, when you're going to have to die of something, I mean, maybe that should be the goal. Although not as important as the goal of preventing cancer in younger people and working on childhood cancers.
But there are commonalities. So on the way back to Joanne, but Sue, is this where we mentioned the paper from, I think it was 2000, The Hallmarks of Cancer?
Yeah.
And its importance in saying that there are common features and we can understand what's going on.
Yeah, absolutely.
That was Weinberg and Hanahan's attempt when they suddenly saw, exactly like you say, George, that it's just such a massive It's just such a difficult and amorphous thing to get your head around. So many different things happening in the cells. And they thought, well, let's pull together some of this stuff. And they then drew up a list of the hallmarks of cancer, the things which happen in every cancer, or almost every cancer. Again, in biology, you can never say every. I'm getting wise to that these days. But they drew up this list of 6 hallmarks of cancer. And now they've added a few more as we've got more information. But it's absolutely brilliant because this has remained the sort of conceptual framework, something into which all the new bits of the jigsaw puzzle can be fitted. And the thing, one of the things that's wonderful about this is various of friends of mine, while I was interviewing them, or interviewees, would say that when you looked at it, you thought, well, what is the common element in all of these hallmarks? And they said, my goodness, it's P53. P53 has a role in every single one of them. Either that it's messed up or that something's happened. But P53 is there, a key player in every one of those hallmarks, which is why, you know, I gave it the title, The Gene That Cracked the Cancer Code. It's there. It again is a nice thing to hang all these various bits of the jigsaw on.
So let me ask here. So we've got two books, both about cancer, and I would think, you know, people who aren't savvy to P53 being the gene so central to everything, they may just walk past that book in a bookstore. You know what I mean? Like, or if someone's afraid of genetics, like bad memories from high school, they may not pick it up, right? So, so when you're writing this book, were you writing it going, you know, this is just a great story that needs to be told and the audience that needs to read it will find it? Or were you hoping to somehow capture a broader audience? And then we'll talk about George's book, because his was written from a different perspective. So,
Well, it's an interesting question, that, because I'm not a biologist. I'm not a trained scientist myself. You know, I grew up in a very medical household where we talked a lot about sciencey things and so on, and I was always fascinated, but I always wanted to be a writer. And so it was sort of natural that I went into journalism and then I went towards the science thing. So to a great extent, I'm the audience for my readers. I find science just fascinating, but I am aware that the deeper I get into a topic, the more I get to know about it, then probably I'm leaving some of my readers behind. But I just think to myself that this is, yes, a really good story. And I also have a burning belief that some really tough science, even tough science, deserves a wider audience. It needs people like, you know, it should reach people like me. And I've worked for a long time with New Scientist magazine, and I think I got a really good training from them about if you use your enthusiasm and make sure you get your facts right, then, you know, you'll carry your audience along. And so I try to give as many stories about the people I've interviewed rather than and the excitement of the chase and the disappointments. So it's a human story of scientific endeavor rather than a mechanical story about a gene and about genetics.
It's not the textbook, this happened and this happened. No. And, I didn't count how many people you interviewed that you included in the book, because you probably interviewed many, many more than were included. But wow, your book ranks up there with, there are so many characters, so many players, just to show how big this field is. And all the stories were interesting. And I always do want to congratulate when people are certain to include the women scientists who've done the work as well as the men, and there were quite a few. So, it's not like this field is lacking for women scientists. Women are drawn towards biology anyway, but for reasons, it's
there
not
are some
important to the book.
such smart women in the P53 field. Really, really wonderful. And the great thing about them is they struck me as so gutsy. You know, there was one wonderful woman in the Weizmann Institute in Israel, Varda Rotter, who was, you know, some of the stuff she discovered was so counterintuitive, and it wasn't, she was saying things that people didn't believe, because when it was discovered to be a tumor suppressor, that its job was to clear out, to stop tumors, there was still a lot of people who thought that it was a tumor driver, that it fueled cancer, and they weren't willing to change their tune. And BARDA stuck by her guns. Her research wasn't showing this. And, you know, and she stuck with it, and she was right. Because under certain circumstances, it's a very, very weird gene that when it's mutated, it can sometimes become a tumor driver as well. And so she knew that it had this dual face, and she stuck with it, and she's been proved right. So there's you know, I met a lot of really bright women in this field, and I added to the attraction of the whole thing too.
I love the book. I feel like I said, compared to perhaps Jeff, who's a physicist, I already come to it as a cell biologist, already finding this stuff super fascinating. So now George's book, you are following along with your wife as she was going through cancer. So tell us a little bit about how, you know, the story came about.
Yeah, I mean, that's really what drew me into the subject. As I mentioned in my introduction, that most of my books have been about cosmology or physics. I wrote a biography of Murray Gell-Mann, the cantankerous physicist who discovered the quark and was kind of Richard Feynman's alter ego. And I wrote a book about quantum computing, and then the ones earlier that the Richard mentioned, Ten Most Beautiful Experiments and Miss Leavitt's Stars, about how we measure the universe because of a discovery that a woman named Henrietta Leavitt made in the early 20th century. So I was looking for something different to write about, because like Sue, I'm not a scientist. I'm a generalist and a journalist, and what I love about this work is I find a subject that I'm absolutely fascinated in, and then it's so wonderful to find a publisher that's willing to stake you with some money to absorb yourself into it for, you know, the 2 or 3 years it can take to come up with a book. So, but in the case of cancer, I was really drawn to it, you know, for what could have been tragic reasons. My former wife, Nancy, was diagnosed with a stage 4 metastatic cancer of a very, very rare sort with a very low survival rate, and at the age of 43. And it's been more than 10 years now, and she's doing fine, so that's the good news. So we're not married any longer, but you know, I kind of play with that in my book. But I started reading about it. You know, we both did at the time. This was back in end of 2003, and then getting into 2004, and I reread an article that I'd read many years ago at Scientific American by Robert Weinberg, one of the two or three probably most prominent cancer researchers, certainly in the United States, and I realized later that it was basically a Scientific American version of what would later become his paper with Hanahan that Sue mentioned, The Hallmarks of Cancer, about all these things that have to go wrong in general for a cancer cell to become cancerous. And it was reading that I really started to realize, wow, this is a little case of miniature evolution going on in your body, and the tumor is evolving all these offenses and defenses and workarounds. I mean, one of the hallmarks is that the tumor starts growing proliferatively. So what it does is it kind of develops through random mutation the ability to basically ignore or turn back signals from the other cells that would normally be regulatory and say, whoa, slow down, you're dividing too fast, you know, we can't keep up with you. And it defeats those, and then it has its own genetic internal mechanisms that are supposed to slow down the cell cycle clock if it's dividing too fast. It learns to defeat those. And then there's one of the great roles of P53 is that it can initiate apoptosis or cellular suicide. So if the cell is just really, really deranged, it can just, you know, set off these molecular death charges and destroy it. But it learns to circumvent apoptosis, another one of the hallmarks. Another hallmark is it learns turn on angiogenesis. Angiogenesis mm-hmm. is the growing blood vessels, and it's this natural mechanism in cells by which, you know, they grow capillaries and then blood supplies. But now the cancer cell co-opts that and hooks into your blood system, you know, both for its own nutrition and to start spreading and metastasizing. Mm-hmm. So that's another hallmark. It develops the ability to metastasize. So it just fascinated me, and that was in my mind for all of these years, and I was thinking there's got to be a way to write a book about this, and it's such a huge subject. I need a narrative framework. So rather than using scientists really as characters, I wanted to use my wife's story. But I didn't want to. There's so many books and many very good ones, you know, where the person with the cancer is right in the forefront, and I wanted. I didn't want to do a book like that. I wanted the Nancy story to kind of hover in the background and just kind of come forth as necessary and use it as a connecting principle. So it's a very different technique. And a lot of my earlier books were very much, people to scientists. You know, you describe what the scientist looks mm-hmm. like, and then you have them talking, or you have scenes at conferences. And I found that book by book, I do less and less of that, and it's just a personal taste probably. But I have a few scenes in my book involving scientists, but more my goal was to absorb the material as best I could myself and kind of come forth and just say it, and then
very nice. There were some lovely bits. I mean, Nancy's story was very nice actually, because it was mm-hmm. it was gently woven in, as you say. It held the story together. It held your quest together, because you've come back to sort of solid things. But also there were some absolutely wonderful scenes where you were obviously sitting there scratching your head or thinking, this is something that really interests me. When you went off to that radio, that place where you sat and that were bombarded with radio waves.
Microwaves, yes, right.
Wonderful. I thought it was such a vivid image, and there were a number of places like that. So I enjoyed. I enjoyed traveling your journey as well, and mine was very much a journey too. Mine was a journey between the scientists and all of that sort of thing. But I really loved your. I mean the. I think that's an important thing in writing about science, that you show that it's a very human endeavor, and that there are people with excitement and the doldrums and all sorts of things like that, and the competitiveness, but also that those of us who it's going to affect and who are interested in it, I think it's quite nice to show our perplexity and our own.
Exactly. Yes, I was just going to say that. I mean, that's another thing. It's taken me a few books to learn, but it's okay to say, like, mm-hmm. you know, wow, I don't get this, and to show your confusion and your struggle trying to understand. Because I remember at some point I just realized I really don't understand this theory called cancer stem cells, Weinberg's thing. And then the more mm-hmm. I talked to a lot of people, including Weinberg and Bert Vogelstein, who doesn't like the theory, and Weinberg, who's a champion of it, I realized that nobody understands this, and it's just kind of this mess, and maybe it's not even true, but maybe it is. So I just realized that was the only way to deal with it, you know, just to kind of, you know, mm-hmm. I'm not a scientist, I'm like an interested outsider taking this journey to try to understand everything I, as a layperson, can understand about cancer, and then try to convey it, but you know, I'm never going to entirely get it, because nobody entirely gets it. It's sort of a collective knowledge.
Science is filled with confusion and dead ends and detours and things. And I don't think you describe those somehow without diverting the story in order to show science honestly, which I think is the best thing to do about science as a human endeavor. It's marvelously successful, and it does have all of these things that happen in it.
Sue had a nice quote in her book, and one of the epigraphs in your chapter from Horace Freeland Judson, who's absolutely I think his book, The Eighth Day of Creation, is the single best science book ever written. And something about how what science is, and And it's so easy for scientists and science writers to write about something without trying to forget everything that was not known at the time the discovery was made, and really capture that sense of looking out into this blank emptiness and not knowing how the story's going to come out. And I thought your Judson quote really, I guess that was from his book about discovery. Yeah.
Yeah.
A marvelous, marvelous book.
Yeah.
I remember, and I have no idea where this imagery came from, and if I could remember, I would credit this person, but I always, one of my favorite things when someone said was, science is like chasing marbles around on the deck of a ship. It's like, yeah, that's what it feels like most of the time. Mm. I do want to ask, you cannot help, and you both, I believe, have mentioned this book, cannot help but bring up Siddhartha Mukherjee's book, The Emperor of All Maladies. Mm-hmm. Now, the reason why I'm only bringing this up because of course, he has the crab sitting on the front. And yeah. I thought that it is almost obligatory for every cancer book to describe the origins of the cancer term, and which I think Sue did pretty much very similarly to Siddhartha. But I felt like, George, you took this idea that, oh, it's after the carcinos, it looked like a crab, but you took it a little further.
Oh, right. Yeah,
like, there was something different about it.
Yeah, like everything, it's not as clear-cut as, I can't remember how I stumbled upon that either. You know, like so many things, I just kind of came upon some old papers that really looked into this and were questioning. Because I think Mukherjee said that in his book someplace too, that, well,
yes,
actually cancer doesn't look anything like a crab, so maybe that stuck in my mind. And then I found this old history of science paper, history of medicine paper, that suggested these alternate derivations. And
I can't remember exactly what the difference was, but I do remember looking at that and thinking, yes, that is interesting. You expanded on it, because I think you told quite a lot of the stories about why it was called cancer. But I think one of the people who suggested it looked like a crab said that it looked like a crab with the way its veins and its blood system had developed. So
Or that it's tenacious, or that...
I'm looking in my book now. I'm trying to find what I wrote.
I know. I should have bookmarked it, and I didn't. Remember, because I listened, and then I was reading Sue's, I was like, oh, wait, everybody's saying this.
This is a derivation that was suggested by a scientist named Lewis Westenra Sambone, a British expert on parasitology. So, and he ended up studying cancer. But he pointed out that there's a creature called Sacculina carcini that feasts on crabs in a manner that's eerily similar to the feasting of a cancerous tumor on a body. And then he described a 1936 report by pathologist Alexander Haddow, who goes on to describe this and suggest that, maybe it was, ancient Greeks dining on crabs and, noticing these kind of parasites. It thought, God, that's just like this cancer that we see over in Hippocrates' patient. And, who knows? It's just, one of those that's things that's probably lost to time. But now... we call it crab. It's so strange that that's what cancer means.
Yeah. So we're down to about 4 or 5 minutes left, so I do want to make sure that our guests both have opportunities to add their two cents, something maybe we forgot to ask, or something important that you want to be sure to share with our readers about either cancer or communicating about cancer and science. It's a free-for-all.
Well, I guess one thing that strikes me is, there's so much folk wisdom about cancer, and people generally in the public, readers of the New York Times or anyone else, readers of these books, they come to them thinking they really know about cancer because they've experienced themselves or someone in their family has experienced cancer, and they have these ideas that, about where cancer comes from. And I had many of these ideas when I started researching the book, and one of the eye-opening things was finding out how many of these were wrong, that there's actually for most cancers, a fairly weak connection between external carcinogens and cancer, mm-hmm. and that for very, very few cases of cancer, actual people getting cancer, you can almost never really trace down, you know, the cause of cancer, if it was actually a cause at all, other than, you know, half a dozen different random mutations, you know, involving the hallmarks of cancer. And the hard part of communicating that is, you know, people just don't believe it, and they get angry, and they think you're part of the sort of some conspiracy at the worst. And mm-hmm. I'm thinking, like, with the cell phones, and I did a column on that a couple of months ago, well about cell phones and electrosensitivity, and I hesitate to mention it because I'm still getting barraged by some of the nastiest emails accusing me of, you know, being in the employee of the Verizon Corporation, and you know, and people who just, you know, just arrogant in their willful ignorance, and you get that a lot with nutrition and cancer too. I mean, of course, it's very important to, you know, pay attention to what you eat, and nutrition is important for many, many reasons, and it has something to do, among many, many, many tiny little risk factors adding up, it has something to do with cancer, but again, it's not nearly as tightly linked as people insist on believing, because mm-hmm. you know, they resent the fact that all of these kale chips they've been eating all these years instead of tostadas and potato chips are not actually probably going to keep them from getting cancer.
Well, I would say that yes, people don't know, and they have an idea that they do. I would say don't be fearful of looking at the biology of these things. I mean, as you say, Joanne, they see the P53 in genetics and they think, ooh, this isn't for me. But I, as I say, I'm not a scientist. I'm just a very interested writer. And I found it, if you engage with it, what goes on inside our cells is just deeply fascinating, and it isn't scary, and it is possible to follow yes. your way down there. Mm-hmm. That's I'd good. Say.
You can't. It's something you can't understand, and you don't have to be a scientist, because you're proof of that. I'm proof of that. And
yeah, that's absolutely.
Right. Well, and Jeff and I have interviewed both authors who are scientists who happen to mm-hmm. write really well. But some of our best books are, you know, writers who are able to and not afraid to delve into the science mm-hmm. and make a perfect, what's the word, you know, this perfect, buffer is not the right word, Jeff, my brain, but someone who's a translator of science, because yeah. they had to
a
go
bridge,
in and learn
bridge.
It. Bridge.
The interstitial thing. The thing I always like to mention at a point like this, and I think it's true for both books, but maybe particularly for Sue's, the P53 story is long and complicated. It is something that can be understood, but not if you read the book fast. There are some books that are fine to read slowly because there are so many ideas, and I like to encourage people not to feel like they're being slow or stupid if they're finding it difficult to understand. Read the book slowly, understanding will grow, and it's worth the time.
Yeah, but a book should be more than a horribly long magazine article, and I think too mm-hmm. many nonfiction books are just like overly long magazine articles. Mm-hmm. You know, you want the, you know, when people really get engaged in a book, you know, they read and they go back and they flip around. It's what's so wonderful about books. It's a very, very different form.
Which is
thinking about what you're reading is a good thing.
yeah, it shouldn't go fast. I mean, You know, fiction can be different, but not necessarily. Yeah.
Well, thanks, Jeff. I agree, because I do think, you know, you have to concentrate. But hopefully, you know, the story is there, and it mm-hmm. is accessible. It is understandable.
Well, that's it. Everything you everything you need as a general reader should be in the book, so you don't mm-hmm. ideally have to go out and look things up. You know, that's part of the skill. It's self-contained, and yet, you know, you're assuming a reader that's smart and thoughtful and wants to ponder things mm-hmm. and find the joy of learning and making connections.
But it can be difficult. It can be difficult knowing exactly who you're writing for, because I remember one person I gave and I thought, well, is this accessible? A very bright person. And he said to me, yeah, he said, that's fine, but what's a mutation? I said, what?
How much do you have to explain? That's always the eternal question.
I thought, well, I'm not going to show that to him again. Otherwise, I'll just I'll freeze.
Yeah.
But it's worth knowing. It's worth knowing. Yeah. You know, you might just put in that it's like a floppy disk that's... We don't have floppy disks anymore. But it's like a disk that's become corrupted. So, you know, it's worth saying these things every so often, putting in a very simple explanation, isn't
it? Yeah,
very,
oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, and doing it gracefully so
not
that you don't turn off the person who knows, but you inform the person who does not. And,
Yeah. Well, you know, George and Sue, you guys are both extremely delightful people. I am so pleased. I was telling Jeff before everything began, I was like, oh gosh, these two are going to be great together. So I had that opportunity to chat with you. If you are looking for great books about cancer, there's a couple right here. So P53, The Gene That Cracked the Cancer Code by Sue Armstrong is a lot of biology, but a lot of human aspects of science. It's a great book. And The Cancer Chronicles, Unlocking Medicine's Deepest Mystery, is told in a slightly different style with following his wife's cancer treatment, diagnosis and treatment. And this, too, is a wonderful story. And I recommend either or both as you have time to read them. And thank you both so much for joining me. And sorry, audience, for leaving. Surprisingly, I got two packages. Sorry, Jeff, neither of them are your birthday presents.
I thought you were leaving. I thought you were going.
I hear the door knock, and it's one package, and then I sit down, and another knock, and it's another package. They needed my signature, so yeah, I guess I'm glad I'm home, but yeah. Sorry to interrupt the show, but that's okay.
Sue and George, thanks so very much for
Thank
such
you.
A time
it was really
conversation.
Fun. Pleasure to meet you, Sue, and all
and
of you.
You, yes, all of you. That was really good. Thank you very much.
Wonderful fun. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Bye.